Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of KCBX and its team of program hosts. Today on Central Coast Voices, join host Mario Espinoza-Kulik and his guests who discuss what recent developments mean for Indigenous land stewardships and how tribal leadership continues to shape environmental protection, cultural revitalization, and land back in movements here on the Central Coast. We invite you to listen, learn, and participate in our conversation today, Thursday, between 1 and 2. You can join the conversation and call in your questions at 805-781-3875, or you can email your questions for later viewing at voices@kcbx.org. With that, let's join Mario and his guests. Over to you, Mario.
Thank you, Brad. Hey, everybody. Welcome in. I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX. Today, we're talking about a major milestone in the ongoing effort to return ancestral lands in San Luis Obispo County. The Yaktichu Tichu Yaktilini Northern Chumash Tribe has received a $7 million Sustainable Agricultural Lands Conservation Grant to support the Land Back campaign to acquire Alexander Ranch, including the old abalone farm just north of Cayucos. This effort is part of a larger $18 million goal to complete the acquisition and hold land for the tribe for the first time since colonization. It's also about stewardship, restoration, cultural revitalization, as was mentioned, and the creation of the Yatspasini Wa Yatspu, or Ocean to Land Conservancy. And joining me for today's show, we have Becca Lucas-Thomas, Yaktichu Tichu Yaktilini Northern Chumash Tribal Member and YTT Northern Chumash Nonprofit Executive Director, as well as Kelsey Schaefer, YTT Northern Chumash Tribal Member and YTT Stewardship Director. Welcome to the show, y'all.
Thank you for having us.
It's my pleasure. And for our guests, if you're listening in, please do call us at 805-781-3875 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org if you want to chime in and have any questions or just get to know us. First of all, welcome to Central Coast Voices one more time. I wanted to start off with Kelsey, if you don't mind, introducing yourself to us in your own words and what your role is at the Northern Chumash Tribe.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us. Hachu, Micha Kalesi, Wamita Ana Yakta Anasmun, Tilhin Katichio. My name is Kelsey, and I am speaking our Tilhini Obispeño Chumash language from San Luis Obispo area. I'm a tribal member of Yaktichu Tichu Yaktilhini. I was born and raised here, born in San Luis, raised in Los Osos, and our family has always been in this area, and I always grew up with stories about our people, about our culture, about our grandmother that spoke our language here, and you know, those stories that come with our history. And so it's an honor to be here in this space now with the tribe. I started working with our tribe, I want to say probably back in like 2011, 2012, with protecting our cultural spaces and our cultural resources, and with that, our living resources. And so through that work, getting involved in restoration and conservation, it's kind of led to, as our tribe has evolved and grown in our own capacity, to be in this place of a stewardship director for our tribe's nonprofit. And so it's an honor to be here and to be working with our families and to be in our homeland, as not everyone is always able to be in our homeland from our tribe. So it's a privilege and an honor.
Becca, how about you? Let us know who you are in your own words and what your role is as the executive director for the YTT Northern Chumash Tribe.
Yeah, so I was also born and raised in San Luis Obispo and moved back to the area a little over 5 years ago at this point now. And when I moved back, became more directly involved in the tribe and different things that we were doing here, continuing some of the work that my mom has really been engaged in for many decades. And some of that really started with revitalizing our cultural fire practices. We've conducted a number of different cultural burns since really returning that practice in 2024 to our people at Johnson Ranch. And we actually have a burn coming up on Monday, a planned burn, all weather a go-go for MUOC open space. And more recently, so at the beginning of last year in 2025, stepped into the position of executive director for our nonprofit. So as a non-federally recognized tribe, we have a nonprofit that acts as our sort of fiscal administrative arm, which is a common practice for different tribes that aren't federally recognized in California, just as a way to be able to do things like apply for grants and engage in different contracts and different legal things that it can be hard to do when you don't have that federal recognition. So in that position, I do a number of different things, including really trying to complete this acquisition and bring this land back for our families.
That's exciting. I'm like thinking about not only just the whole principle of land repatriation, but to have in a sort of focal point for our listeners and people in the community to know, like, what is a land back movement and what does that look like in terms of organizing, I think has been, like, as somebody who's external, like, watching it from the outside, is just like, SLO has a land back campaign like that. Like, I never thought that we would see something like that since I've been here. So I just wanted to say, like, that the campaign and the work that has been going into the land back organizing that the YTT Northern Chumash Tribe is doing is just inspiring.
Thank you.
I also wanted to ask you, and I'll start back with you, Kelsey, what brought you into this work related to, like, the land return, the cultural revitalization, and the conservation efforts that y'all do?
Well, I guess it's good to say that, you know, we always grew up with pieces of our culture with us, and whether that is through stories from, you know, my grandfather or my great-grandfather who didn't want to tell stories because he grew up in that era where it was not safe to be an Indian. It was not safe to share your Indian identity. And if, you know, our families would ask him questions like, you don't need to know those things. You know, he grew up out at Lopez Canyon as one of the last generations to grow up at our grandma Rosario homestead out there. And my great-grandfather, James Lathrop, his great-grandmother was Rosario Cooper, and she was known as one of the last speakers of our language. And she worked with ethnographer John P. Harrington back in the early 1900s to document our language, to talk about our culture, our families, our places, the things that our people did. And so I grew up hearing these stories, and my grandpa would tell us, you know, your grandmother back in the day, she would go to the mission and she would sing Indian songs and tell Indian stories to the children. There's a recording of her somewhere. I don't know where that recording is. And I was a little girl, you know, thinking, oh, this was over 100 years ago. Who knows whatever happened to that recording or who has it. But as I got into my young 20s, finding out that, oh, it's at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. There's roughly 10,000 pages of her work with J.P. Harrington that's housed there. At that time, those documents were not digitized. If you wanted to see our grandmother's words or hear her songs, you had to go to Washington, D.C., get access at the Smithsonian or at the Library of Congress, where maps and audio files are held. And so, you know, we went over there, a group of us, my mother, our tribal chair, Mona Tucker, and then one of our other elder cousins, Debbie Murillo. A group of us went over there with the Breath of Life conference, and we were able to spend 2 weeks in those archives. And our tribe had tasked us with trying to take pictures of reel one. We have 5 reels. Each reel is about 2,000 pages. And so we were there just taking pictures after pictures of these documents as we're also trying to read them and just absorb as much as we can, knowing these papers were on our grandmother's table and we're touching the same papers that she probably touched. And to see pictures and to hear the songs that she sang. And so, you know, just through these stories that I grew up knowing and hearing just with our family, and coming in as an adult with my own children, wanting to make sure that they knew their identity and their connection to this land. And that revitalization of culture, of knowledge, of songs, of language, of protecting places of old villages or old prayer sites. That's just – it's an internal responsibility that you don't really have a choice in it. You know, it's something that as development is happening and you see, you know, graves or burials being upturned and you see things just being put into museums, however those things play out, it's just a calling that was like, this is something that – is our responsibility to care for our heritage and to care for our history and to honor our families that came before us that fought so hard to survive. And, you know, my great-grandfather, Jimmy Lathrop, his generation was the last one to grow up out at Lopez before the land was taken for water rights to build the Lopez Dam. And he, along with his uncle, who is Mona Tucker's father, Tim Olivas, you know, they were standing against that development and trying to protect that space. It's work that has always been a part of our families. We've always been trying to have a voice to speak for this place, to carry out our responsibility to care for all of life's existence here, and to try and keep balance in the natural world with all of the people, not just humans, but with all of the life, as we're all connected and have equal value. And so just growing up, I think mostly having my own kids is something that I wanted them to just be very connected and in tuned with at the youngest age that they could, to not grow up and question or not know their belonging here. You know, we have villages right here that our family is from, in Avila, Sapatu, in Pepatsu, in Montana de Oro, Chanu, in Los Osos. There are certain places that our family lineage comes from. And without even knowing exactly, you know, which locations all of those are at, there's a calling and a belonging that you feel there. And so really just being so close to my grandparents and my great-grandparents and having my kids young, and now I have a grandson, it's just so important to make sure that our families don't forget where we come from and that we hold on to our identity, and not just knowing but practicing bringing back traditions that our grandparents weren't allowed to carry out because of discrimination, because of government you know, action to hunt the Indian, to save the man. There's all of these different phases of violence and discrimination that different generations went through. And, you know, an elder some years ago at a conference I was at had spoken, and he was asked, you know, on the census, where are all these Indians coming from? And he said, we've always been here. We were in hiding, but we're not hiding no more. And so it's just that empowering feeling to know that our responsibility in this time of day, where we are allowed to be vocal, we are allowed to have our voices without being punished for it. It's the responsibility that we have.
Yeah. And ever take up that space. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that's something that I think I was trying to pay attention to, is the visibility of the work is so much more prominent in the 2020s than ever before. But I want to say to folks who have just tuned in, you know, I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. As we continue Central Coast Voices, our guests today are Becca Lucas-Thomas, YTT, or Yaktichitichu Yaktilini Northern Chumash Tribal Member, and YTT Northern Chumash Nonprofit Executive Director, and Kelsey Schaefer, YTT Tribal Northern Chumash Tribal Member, and YTT Stewardship Director. We've been getting to know them a little bit. We just heard from Kelsey Schaefer, but I do want to turn back to Becca to let us know a little bit about, you know, your coming into this role.
It's always hard to follow Kelsey in a very good way. I mean, growing up here, it's hard not to be in love with our surroundings. I mean, this is a really beautiful place for a lot of different reasons. And one of my sort of favorite practices. And I also teach at Cal Poly, and I teach Indigenous land management. And one of the practices I really invite for my students, too, is to think about how beautiful we know and sort of expect California to be, and knowing that all of that was carefully created by our ancestors here in today's San Luis Obispo County and the ancestors throughout this entire state. So as Kelsey said, you know, it's our responsibility and honor, and at times, you know, a lot of work that we don't really get to sort of shut off at the end of a work day because it's something that we carry within us and we can't not carry that forward, to do what we can to protect these really important spaces, these really important species, and all the things that have allowed everyone who came before us not only to survive but also thrive and really create this incredible landscape that now supports all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, it is incredible. I was just in Morro Bay walking along the boardwalk to see the marshlands, and it's just like unreal. You know, I've never been anywhere else in the country that looks like that.
Yeah.
But again, for people who are maybe tuning in or learning about the Yaktichu Yaktili Northern Chumash tribe for the first time, what would you want them to understand is like the YTT's presence in San Luis Obispo County?
I would say our presence has always been here. Our people have been here for over 10,000 years. And we say that because it's been for a time immemorial. And that's a hard word to kind of quantify. Immemorial, what does that mean? It's for countless generations, for thousands and thousands of years, through all of the changes of the environment, of culture. We have always been here to adapt in this space with the world around us, not extracting the world around us for our use, but really living in balance with it, knowing that we're all a part of it. We have a responsibility to know that everything that we do impacts the world around us. The world around us impacts us. There is no separation between us and nature. And so we've always been here. We know this. And this is something that for us, more recent years, you know, in the last 250 years, our way of life was disrupted, but it was not erased, in the sense of we're the same people in the same places doing the same things. It just looks a little different. Right, we've always adapted, and we have always transformed to future. And our responsibilities here are for remembering and honoring the lessons and the knowledge that our ancestors have cultivated here, that have learned, and then to reinvest that into our future. We've always been here, but more recently we've been landless. The government system has completely changed in so many ways, the way our government system is able to exist and exert our own sovereignty in our homeland. And a lot of folks may ask, you know, are you a part of the other Chumash tribe, right? You guys have a reservation. You are federally recognized. What most people don't maybe know and aren't taught in the public school system is that the Chumash people as a whole are made up of several language groups, at least 8 distinct languages that have been documented. And each one of those languages has their own territory, their own government, their own social structure and social order with responsibilities, and even different cultures, right? We have some different practices from each other. Our languages are distinct with dialects within them, and we're related the way Italian and Spanish are related to each other. But we are not all the same. And we, you know, what the reservation has, we don't have. What we have here, we don't get from them, and vice versa. We have rights to spaces of where our families are from, and that is old way. That is traditional way. If we want to go into anyone else's homeland or territory, then we need to be invited. We need permission, and we can't just enter someone else's area or lump us with other Chumash tribes because we are all unique in our own rights, and we are all sovereign in our own rights. And that's something that has always been. That's something that still exists today, and that's something that will always exist in the future. And I think that's something that not everyone always realizes, and we get a lot of questions about how the Chumash tribes are or aren't related, and you know, how relationships between other tribes have changed or evolved or existed over time.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was excellently put. I mean, for me, I feel like I would just tell my students to come talk to you about sovereignty, and just in terms of our listeners, I think it's really important to, you know, for folks to know, when we talk about sovereignty, we're talking about the right to govern ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. To govern, like, as a parallel nation to the United States, mm-hmm. of America, to, you know, Canada, Mexico, etc. But think about that for 1 second, that there are over 500 like federally recognized sovereign tribes, mm-hmm. and then even more like unfederally recognized sovereign tribes. So mm-hmm. to be living inside of a quote-unquote sovereign nation and being sovereign nations is just, I think, something of a multiverse, mm-hmm. that is real life. So if y'all folks are interested in what that plays out like in real life, maybe you should understand more about indigenous sovereignty, mm-hmm. And how tribes are, you know, how to work with tribes locally, and that includes in terms of treaties. You know, the legibility of the United States government is only due in part by the supreme law of the lands, which are treaties signed mm-hmm. between tribes. Mm-hmm. So tribes gave the United States the permission to call itself a sovereign entity. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that to everyone.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
I mean, we talk about this a lot because that concept of having, as you said, you know, we have 574 plus one more recently added federally recognized tribes across the entire nation. 109 of those are just in California itself. And then many more non-federally recognized tribes throughout this entire country. And exactly as you said, you know, nationhood is about people. It's about governance. It's not about place. It helps for sure, but we are a sovereign nation even as a landless tribe. And you know, for anyone who's listening who maybe is still having trouble grokking that concept, if you've seen Thor Ragnarok, Asgard is a people, not a place, right? We mm-hmm. have that concept elsewhere, and we can sort of see how that plays out. But yeah, it's about peoplehood. It's about governance structure, and land isn't a requirement, mm-hmm. though it is incredibly helpful and something that we're really working on to return to our nation.
Yeah.
And just to add to that, you know, sovereignty means we don't ask permission to be sovereign. That is something that Creator has already given to us. And so in the structure that is our American government today, who issues recognition such as federal recognition, that's nice and sweet and all, and it comes with certain benefits, you know, with the BIA and whatnot. However, that does not validate or create your Indianness. You know, that does not give you permission to be sovereign. We are not a federally recognized tribe, and we are a sovereign nation, period. No matter what kind of benefits we do or do not get, or recognition we do or do not get from the American government, it doesn't change our government. It doesn't change our culture and our history and our heritage and our belonging here. There are certainly benefits to it. There's also some downsides to it as mm-hmm. well. And those are different things that is new to navigate over the last couple of hundred years. And as we know, there are treaties in California that were not ratified. And that wasn't the first time that any land negotiations failed for our people. You know, there was land negotiations both with the Spanish government when the Mexican government took over and secularized the missions. The mission grounds were negotiated to be given to the mission Indians. And the Mexican government had agreed to that and said, yep, all fine and dandy. But then once they took control, the land grants went out to predominant Mexican families, and our people who lost out on that land then had to find their way of how do we stay in our homeland. Now we have to go and find work on these ranches because suddenly fences are put up on the land that we had free roaming access of. You know, the mission system came along and it removed us from our villages and stole people to go into this free labor force for the Spanish missions. And then after that, the land was removed from us through fencing, through these land grants, where now this different concept of ownership of land, ownership of resources and lifeways was introduced. And then the American government came along. They weren't interested in ratifying those treaties. They certainly negotiated them. However, it was more concerned with how do we exterminate Native Americans because they have these claims. We can't beat them and defeat them in violence acts, right? And so how can we systematically commit this genocide attempt, which is what it truly was, this attempt at erasure of culture. You see that through the boarding schools of taking children away, cutting their hair, not letting them speak their languages, not letting them pray, not letting them visit their prayer sites. And then you have the elders of families that weren't able to teach their kids because they were going to be punished at school if they did these things. Things became very under the rug. And then now fast forward to today where it's more recently been even trending, I would say, to become Native American and identify in that way. And it's created a different set of obstacles. It's opened some doors and avenues that were closed for so long, but it's also kind of created this frenzy around a competition of resources and a competition of claiming an identity or associating with an identity that could benefit certain families in different ways. And so just kind of navigating the Western government is challenging in some ways because it doesn't align with our traditional government systems and our worldview and values that we hold. And so just kind of standing firm in that way of being true to who our culture and what our culture is, but also as modern Native Americans of this day, what does that look like and how do we go through these partnerships and creating nonprofits so that we can legally exist as an entity because our tribe doesn't exist as an entity since it's not federally recognized.
And we're going to get more into that when we come back from our break. We're going to take one short break to hear back from our team and we'll be right back on Central Coast Voices.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, ahead of the Men's World Cup, we bring you a new show from Futuro Studios. It's all about soccer culture in the U.S. and its underdog roots.
Why do I watch the World Cup? That's like asking me, why do I breed?
It's called American football. And that's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, Clark Peters. His breakout role was in the HBO series The Wire as police detective Lester Freeman. In Spike Lee's The Five Bloods, he was a Vietnam veteran. In real life, Peters opposed the war and was arrested at a protest which changed his life. He moved to London, starred in musicals there, and now stars in the series The Burrows. Join us.
The elk antler industry, yes, you heard that right, is booming, it seems, and it's partly thanks to dog toys.
It's almost like a Charleston chew of antler because the bone is really, really thin. There's lots of marrow, and they just love that part.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, all things elk antler, next time on Marketplace.
That's a look ahead to what's coming up here this afternoon on KCBX. Latino USA follows this program from 2 till 3. Then it's Fresh Air from 3 to 4 and Marketplace from 4 to 4:30. Right now, let's return to Mario Espinosa-Kulik and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Mario.
Thank you, Brad. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Dr. Mario Espinosa-Kulik. Our guests today are Becca Lucas-Thomas, Yaak Tichu Tichu, Yaak Tulini Northern Chumash Tribal Member, and YTT Northern Chumash Nonprofit Executive Director, as well as Kelsey Schaefer, YTT Northern Chumash Tribal Member, and YTT Stewardship Director. We've been getting to know more about yourselves and the tribe, as well as the relationship to land post-colonization, slash, I don't even know why I said post-colonization. It doesn't feel like we're in a post-colonial world, especially True. These days. But I wanted to kind of look more deeply into this history, right? We did a little bit about that before coming back here right now. But just for our listeners that are coming in, for generations, Native families have had to protect their children and survive by hiding culture, identity, and community ties, as Kelsey mentioned. This moment offers a different possibility by honoring those who came before, restoring tribal responsibilities to land and water, and showing how Indigenous knowledges and practices benefit the larger community and the natural world. If you're interested or curious about what any of this means, call us at 805-781-3875 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Some exciting news that we're going to learn about today is that there's a $7 million sustainable agricultural lands conservation grant that is going to make possible to realize a right to return to Yaktichu Yaktilini Northern Chumash land. Do you want to please start us off by telling us what is the SALC grant, Becca?
Absolutely. So the Sustainable Agricultural Lands Conservation Program is a California Strategic Growth Council supported program overall, but administered by the California Department of Conservation. And this is a program that's been around for a good number of years now. That's part of the California Climate Investments. So a big focus of this is to really reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And the way that this program does it is through the protection of sustainable agricultural lands themselves through conservation easements or fee title purchases, as well as trying to support infill development to limit sprawl. So it's been really effective for a number of years. And both the Department of Conservation and Strategic Growth Council have been really nimble and effective in being able to update and attune their programs to help support tribes too, in recognition that, you know, a lot of the work that tribes do today maybe isn't what we would consider sort of traditional or conventional ag in the same sense, but it's still cultivation of land, cultivation of important food crops, stewardship of important species. And so this program is something that we're eligible to apply for, and we were successful in being able to get $7 million from this most recent round that was awarded just at the end of April. So this is a really big boost to our efforts, which is really exciting and important. This piece of property that we're talking about, that we are engaged in a purchase agreement for, Alexander Ranch, or sort of well known to most people as the Old Abalone Farm just north of Cayucas, is about 350 acres. So it's not small, it's not enormous, but it's, you know, a good size of land that stretches on both sides of the Highway 1 and includes coastline, as well as this really unique and remarkable 19-acre aquaculture facility, a piece of the Via Creek riparian corridor that actually abuts right up to State Park's Estero Bluffs Via Creek estuary, and a number of different grasses and, you know, sort of what was once and currently some grazing lands, but what we're really excited to sort of adapt and adopt with our cultural fire stewardship practices and other traditional tending.
What is the, in terms of the Via Creek, I was curious, like, why is this important in terms of the story, the all-encompassing story historically and ecologically?
Yeah, so Via Creek, you know, prior to missionization, there's villages there at Via Creek. Satkala is the name of our village place there, and it's right where kind of Via Creek and Elsley Creek both combine to lead out into this estuary out on the mouth of the creek there that leads out to the ocean. And so our family has a history of being there in occupation as a place that supported our families and our livelihood. But on top of that, it is at the mouth of a small estuary area. And as we know, our estuary spaces, they are – they support an abundance of life, both marine life as well as a riparian life. And it has this, you know, brackish transitional area that is really unique. And in California and all along the Pacific coast, these spaces are disappearing due to development, human occupation, or population rather. And so this particular area, it supports and historically had supported a lot of keystone species as well. You know, we have a lot of sensitive protected life that lives there, such as, you know, western pond turtle, the tidewater goby fish are there. You know, it's a
red-legged frog.
The red-legged frog. You know,
monarch, it's overwintering habitat.
Exactly. There's so much there. And it's been degraded, heavily degraded, over the last couple of hundred years due to ranching activities. The riparian corridor and where it leads into the mouth of the creek has really been channelized to man the creek and its movement, natural movement, to kind of stabilize that for the use of the ranch, for the road and the highway going through. There's been a lot of infrastructure that's been put in, a lot of like native plants throughout that area too have kind of been taken over by invasives. The walls of the creek in the riparian corridor there have been heavily impacted due to grazing. And so there's a lot of efforts, and our priorities are, our responsibility is to care for this landscape. And it's unique in the fact, too, that the headwaters of Via Creek are owned and managed by the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County. And then the mouth of the creek is owned by our state parks, both of which have conservation and restoration projects. And so for our part of the creek that we're trying to purchase now would put this watershed into conservation in its entirety. And I believe the only other watershed in our area that is in conservation in some sense is with Hearst Castle, because they own the entire watershed. So it'll be a really unique opportunity for us to connect this watershed in conservation and protection.
That's exciting. When it's all said and done, what's like the vision, like the dream of like what would you like it to look like for your future generations?
We have lots of dreams. We have lots of visions. we want to be super clear for anyone who's listening. There is no casino that's any part of this vision or dream for a number of reasons. Namely, we cannot have a casino. We are not a federally recognized tribe. So that's not even an option that's available to us.
But if we were, we still wouldn't have a casino. That is not on our dream list.
No. Actually, part of receiving this grant means that we're restricting future development. So this is something that we're protecting in terms of any future development beyond the areas that are already existing out there and, you know, needed or necessary improvements down the line. Mm-hmm. But this protects that land for us in perpetuity from development. And then if anything were to happen in the future and that land goes, you know, to someone else, that development would still be restricted. So that's part of this grant program too. So it really does protect the land in that way permanently. Mm-hmm. But one of the major pieces of this that we're working on is that Yat Spicini Wayatspu Conservancy, which translates to Ocean to Land Conservancy, because the projects that we have really are both on the ocean and the land. So, you know, Kelsey talked about the Via Creek riparian corridor restoration that we're working on, really wanting to protect all the different grassland species and sort of the chaparral species that are on the north side of the property with our cultural fire practices and more. And then also working on the aquaculture facility to update it and to be able to restore back abalone, I was saying black abalone in particular, because that's something that we're really working on in actual marine restoration in the water. But the aquaculture facility itself presents a really remarkable opportunity for conservation efforts that are ongoing throughout the state already, and that really require additional facilities that are appropriate and possible to create this connected conservation and stewardship of a bunch of different marine life that includes abalone.
And I think it's important to share, too, you know, this property, it had the old abalone farm on it. So a lot of people know, okay, abalone, right? That's what it's all about. But our plans for it are to be an actual aquaculture facility with multiple species. Abalone, it takes a lot of time to cultivate and to grow. Black abalone have not successfully been grown in an aquaculture facility. However, also working on red abalone and white abalone as well. But beyond that, you know, the partners that we're working with and talking to, we are talking about also prioritizing and growing seaweed so that would also help the production and growth of red and white abalone in the facility, as well as figuring out how to best support the black abalone population, if that can be something supported by in the aquaculture facility, or if that's just through translocation activities, which we've been involved in and working with partners on, but also to open up that research into other species, such as like the starfish, right? There's different starfish out here, and those are truly a keystone species for the health of our kelp forest. And if folks aren't super familiar with the kelp forests that are off of our coast, they are unique and also disappearing in the ocean, but they are one of the largest ecosystems in the entire world that have so much play in our environment and the health of our environment, the health of our oceans, which affects the health of our land as well. And so really having this wholesome view and approach to aquaculture and making sure that, you know, also in that restoring our own cultural revitalization in our food ways, helping other tribes reconnect to these traditional food ways as well. Seaweed itself has mm-hmm. so many uses, not just mm-hmm. as a food, but even in supporting green, green environment initiatives and whatnot. With it can be used in cattle feed to help with that. It can be used in
replace plastics,
replacing different plastic packaging. Yeah. It's been done in other parts of the world. It's part of skincare. There's so many possibilities where it comes to the aquaculture facility, and we are just lucky that this piece of land has this type of infrastructure, and it's not something like a paper company that has no ties to our culture, but it's something that would actually support our restoration and conservation goals that we have.
I'm curious. You mentioned Satkala. Mm-hmm. Like, what does that look like in terms of restoring, like, the land to what it should be and not, like, recreating Alexander Ranch, but being like, this is like, mm-hmm. like this is where it was eroded, but this is where it is now. I guess that's like what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I mean, the amazing thing about it having been under John Alexander's, you know, care and estate now for decades is that it's really been undeveloped for a long time. So a lot of those habitats remain intact. They mm-hmm. need a little bit of, support and help in some areas. And of course, invasive species are just kind of part of our life at this point. But there's so many different ecosystem types out there. I mean, you've got our coastal sage scrub in some areas, the chaparral, the grasslands, obviously the riparian zone, and some kind of like wetlands, marshy areas. So a lot of this would be, I mean, right now, some of the work that we're doing is ensuring that we have a full understanding of all the different species that are out there so that we know what plan to have to be able to enhance those species. There's so many different basket weaving plants that are out there, and those in particular really want fire. So there's a really incredible canvas to start with already. Mm-hmm. The main focus of restoration really is on that riparian zone, just because, as Kelsey mentioned, a lot of the erosion there has had an impact on its integrity. It doesn't flow all year long. So there's different pieces of that we can work really intentionally on to bring back.
Yeah, so part of that will also include some of removing some of those man-made barriers. You know, there's different concrete tanks that are in where the flow of the creek would historically have ran through. There's a group of students at Cal Poly that are working on a project to look through old maps and whatnot to kind of track where the creek has flown in the past when it was freely flowing. And so we're going to be using some of that research and history to kind of help guide our restoration efforts, especially where it connects to the estuarian restoration projects. But beyond the ecological restoration, the cultural revitalization of Wetzlatkala, right, that village place for us, what does that look like? It also includes people on the land. Mm-hmm. We are a part of nature, and we've been a part of this landscape, and there is not a picture that does not include us. And one of the main things that our families have voiced is, you know, there's been a lot of historical displacement of families. And so not all of our families are able to live in San Luis Obispo County. And when they come back to our homelands, whether that's for their own personal time, whether that's for family gatherings with the tribe, whatever that might be, it is a struggle to find a place to gather as a group. We always have to rent out a space or find a partner that is willing to donate space for us to gather at. We have to figure out housing. We do a lot of camping. We'll do a lot of dry camping in places that don't even have a fire pit there for us. We have to invite people to our homes. It's a lot of logistics and travel to figure out how can families actually connect to their homeland without having to ask permission to get through a locked door or a locked gate. And so something that this provides us an opportunity is having a home base for our families. If someone wants to come because, hey, they need to go gather, they need to go pray, you know, we're gathering our traditional foods, gathering for traditional medicines. We have people that are basket weavers. We have people that create jewelry, that create artwork. We have people that are revitalizing language. We have people who hunt, right? There's so many of these different things, and fishing that access to spaces has been very much a barrier. And so this would give us a chance to have a place for families to come to so we can hold our language classes rather than finding somewhere to hold our language classes. We can have our cooking classes. You know, we can have a place where we can teach our youth, okay, what season is this plant healthy? What season are you able to process this plant? When is it right for gathering? What are the different pieces of the plants that are right for gathering? What is your relationship with that plant? So, like, what is that use? What is our responsibility, too? Because we talk about rights to things and the right to purchase this land, but rights do not come without responsibilities. And that is something that we very clearly understand is that they go hand in hand, rights and responsibilities. And so it's never just going to be an extraction of the land. And so having this space where also we can access the ocean. We are a maritime culture. We have a very deep understanding and relationship with the ocean and with all of the ocean people that live there. And it's very hard and it's very unique to be able to have a tribe own land that has access to the coastline. It's nearly unheard of in California. It's very rare. And so that is huge also to be able to give our families this space to revitalize our culture, to teach our values, our worldview, and our practices to a youth in this hands-on, meaningful way that is not needing to give something up for someone else to give us this space. And I think that's something that our families are really, really looking forward to. We have no plans to expand on the building envelopes as far as developing out there. You know, we'll have a campsite, I think, and we want to be able to have places for our, like, native garden and have our food boxes for our elders and our medicine boxes and make those things available. We want to be able to have ceremony, have our dances out there, invite our kin tribes, other Chumash, Yoka, Salinan, Mono. We have relationships with these other tribes that are long-standing relationships, and we have not had a place to invite them to come for dances or ceremony. And that's something traditionally that we have done. Actually, at Villa Creek, that's a place during the Mexican era, the ranches were okay with having ceremony there. It was one of the last places in our homeland we were able to have ceremony. So for it to be the first place for us to come back to and to be able to host these things and then be able to provide workforce training, to be able to invest in our future so that our youth can find opportunities in stewardship spaces, in legal spaces, in research, in the scientific field. It seems like the potential there is endless. And we don't do this in a vacuum. This is not just our tribe doing this. We work with partners a lot. We work with universities. We work with other tribes. And we want to have that continued partnership going into the future and do it in a way that really aligns with our values and is truly a tribal-led culture.
It's very exciting, very beautiful. The future does sound very bright, and not only bright, but like what is like sparkly, like when the water, the sun hits the water and
all
it's
glimmery.
Kind of glimmery. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the future sounds glimmery. I'm Dr. Mario Espinoza-Kulik with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you have recently joined us for today's Central Coast Voices and want to listen to the entire broadcast, you can. It'll be available on our website at www.kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you'll find this show and many others to choose from. You can also find this show and many others by saying on your smart speaker, hi, play Central Coast Voices on KCBX. I don't want to endorse any one of those bots, but if you have a bot that talks to your house, talk to it and look for us. To learn more about the Yak Teacher Teacher Yak Tilin Northern Chumash Tribe, visit yttnorthernchumashtribe.com. You can also follow updates from the nonprofit on Instagram at yttnonprofit. Now, we're about to wrap up right now, but I want to focus on how our listeners can move from learning to action. There is an overall goal of $18 million to complete the Alexander Ranch acquisition, and the community can be part of this effort. So this work is about land, it's about water, it's culture, it's ecology, it's conservation, and it's also, I think, most importantly, about future generations on the Central Coast. Mm-hmm. So returning to our guests, we have with us Becca Lucas-Thomas, Yak Tichu Tichu Yak Tilini Northern Chumash Tribal Member, and YTT Northern Chumash Nonprofit Executive Director, and Kelsey Schaefer, YTT Northern Chumash Tribal Member, and YTT Stewardship Director. So what is the gap, Becca, between what you have and what you're aiming to get?
Yes. So in committed funds right now, we're at about $11 million, a little over $11 million of our $18 million. We have some more grants that we're waiting on to hear from. So our gap is closing, but we still have a gap. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of people who are interested in supporting us and who say, like, I don't have millions of dollars. And we say, that's cool. Neither do we. But there's so many different ways that people can really support this effort. And financially, of course, we are, still trying to get to that total purchase price. And then beyond that, we'll continue to support the stewardship activities out there with our stewardship fund. So there's certainly ways to make enduring gifts there. But also just learning about their project, learning about our tribe, learning our name, and being able to share that with the community. This place is so special. I mean, it's just a really special location for a lot of reasons, but the old abalone farm, I think, holds a special place for many people in this community who have been there over the years, whether, you know, school visit from decades ago or in some other sort of working relationship. And so it really is this nostalgic place for a lot of people, I think. And, you know, abalone is definitely part of what we plan to bring back there. But as Kelsey talked about, a number of other species as well. The work that we'll do there really will benefit the full community because this is all in pursuit of cleaner air, cleaner water, not just our cleaner water in the riparian corridor there, but then also, you know, the effluent from the aquaculture facility, all of that pumping of the ocean water in through those marine invertebrates creates cleaner, better ocean water coming out the other side. So that really spills out into our larger ocean area as well. So we're, learning about it, telling us you want to learn more, you want to tell your friends about it, right? Just the excitement and the momentum that we've seen from our community here in particular has really been, it's been exciting and it's been hopeful. And I think a lot of people really want to see this come back to us. So,
and if folks are interested in volunteering or partnering in any of these activities, go onto our website. There is a way to reach out and connect with us. There is also a donate option on our website. So, you know, even if it's $5, $100, or if you do have millions of dollars and you're looking for a tax write-off for the year, we would love to receive any kind of support and in any way or fashion, monetary or other. So check out our website, yttnorthernshumashtribe.com.
Yes, I strongly believe that there are people with money out there who can easily just dish out some money. I mean, I just saw on the news on the way here that like there was a gubernatorial candidate who had $9 million, you know, as a fundraising campaign for their candidacy, who dropped out. So we're at about $9 million for this gap.
Easy peasy transfer, I think.
So definitely, if you have the resources, if you have the heart, if you have even just the will to see and be a part of correcting pain that you may not have inflicted but have a desire to resolve, then this might be a good option for you to spend some of that money. I also did want to open it up for anything we might not have gotten to today. I know there's so much to be said about the land stewardship, but if you have just 1 to 5 words to leave our listeners with before we end.
You know, we don't have a word for goodbye in our language. We don't believe in goodbye. And so a lot of times we say shimokini. It means always. We're going to see you again. So thank you for having us. And just to share some language, shimokini to all listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much for your interest in this project. And thank you to the community for all the support you've given us thus far. And we're really closer than we have been in, you know, 250 years to finally being able to bring our people home.
So great to have you both here, Becca and Kelsey. Thanks for being on Central Coast Voices with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We do hope that you'll tune into next time for Central Coast Voices on Thursday, June 11th at 1 p.m. with host Fred Monroe and his guest Michael Latner to discuss the Voting Rights Act and the U.S. Supreme Court. Central Coast Voices is co-produced by the show's hosts in collaboration with KCBX. We depend on folks like you to continue these programs, so please donate today or become a member with your monthly donation online at www.kcbx.org. I'm your host, Dr. Mario Espinosa-Kulik. Bye-bye.